Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today's the third Monday of the month where we look at business, we look at work-life balance issues and different career lifestyles. Joining us live today, we'll have Jezra Kay, president of Speak Up for Success. She'll share how to manage the unmanageable. And I have to tell you, the same rules apply at work as they do at home. Great, great work that she's done. We're also going to bring you two pre-recorded interviews that I taped last week. One with Katie Davis, truly the most amazing 22-year-old I've ever come into contact with. And if you think one person can't make a difference, then stay tuned. You'll find out what she's doing. First, I sat down with Gallup executive Tom Reiger. He says a company's worst enemy is not always the competition. Sometimes it's the fear within that company. And with the economy the way it's been, we, of course, have seen an increase on that. Reiger has studied the fear of loss. He's studied the fear of missed expectations from the boardrooms of America to the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. And he knows how it leads to instability and harmful behavior throughout. He's the leader and chief architect of Gallup's global consulting efforts to identify and remove barriers to success. And he's been studying organizational and consumer behavior since 1986. His new book is called Breaking the Fear Barrier. And he's going to share how fear destroys companies from the inside out and what we can do about it. Here's that interview now. So first of all, Tom, I want to welcome you to Conversations Live. Your new book is called Breaking the Fear Barrier. And this is a subject that I find fascinating because as a communications consultant, I go into many different companies. And I'm always amazed by the different dynamics and yet at the same time, the number of similarities and patterns that occur. So tell us how this book came about for you. I understand that you work with Gallup, and I understand you were being called into companies who declared they were stuck. On the surface, everything looked okay. What was going on underneath?
Well, Vicki, it was interesting because we weren't looking for fear as the root cause, but as you said, these companies were stuck. They seemed to be doing the right things. They had the right metrics, the right tools, but something was clearly getting in the way or acting as a barrier. And it didn't matter if it was a manufacturing plant or a call center or a bank or a retailer. It was like we were seeing the same movie again and again and again. And what was holding these companies back was fear. And what I mean by fear is fear of loss. You may have had a manager sitting in their office thinking, if I get hit with one more meeting, one more exception that I have to make, if I lose one more penny of budget, one more headcount, I'm not going to meet my goals. So I need to put up some walls and some rules to protect myself. Now, the problem is, while those rules and policies and practices may have helped one small part of the organization, often it was at the expense of other groups who needed that exception or needed something to be done. Or sometimes those walls got so high that that department started to define their world by the piece and not the puzzle.
Right. And has this sense of fear, this sense of loss, increased with the situation with the economy?
You know, Vicki, I've been studying consumer and organizational behavior in one form or another since 1986. And in all that time, I have never seen so much fear in the workplace. Just to give you an idea of how prevalent this problem is, we did a poll of U.S. working adults, about 2,600 of them, and found that half, 50%, are what we call prisoners. And a prisoner is someone who lives in a fear-ridden, barrier-laden organization. They have strong limits on their empowerment, everything's subjective, and they're very, very disengaged, only in the 8th percentile. Now, the good news is, if you strip these barriers away, that engagement level jumps all the way up to the 87th percentile. But yes, it's very prevalent. Right?
Yeah, and it's really shocking to think that 50% of people consider themselves a prisoner within their company. That is really shocking. That should be incentive enough for companies to do something about it, right?
Well, you would think, absolutely. But you know, you have to remember, these barriers are born with the best of intentions. A lot of times, they just seem like these insurmountable things that are always there, but it's important to remind executives, managers, and employees that nowhere does it say on the eighth day God created barriers. These are things that the company did to itself. And if you did it to yourself, guess what? You can undo it. You have to take some time and unpack it and get to the root cause. But these are things that can be fixed.
Right. And you say that, you know, because the question might arise, well, how does it start in the first place? Especially when we're looking at, you know, some of the companies that I work with are relatively young, you know, maybe 10 years old. You would think they would have lost all this hierarchy and bureaucracy, and you'd have think they'd have come in with a fresh approach. But it usually starts with one person with power, you say in the book.
That's right. And it actually becomes worse through poorly managed growth, because what happens is, as you grow, I mean, where this power issue comes from is your business becomes more complex. As your business becomes more complex, you have to start dividing up functions, right? You know, you may have to form an HR department, and then as you grow more, you may have to split that into training and recruiting. You may have to split up sales and marketing, and so on and so on. And then you have to put people in charge of each of those individual departments and give them goals to succeed. But the problem is, it becomes very easy for the focus to be on just that local success and lose sight of the broader organization. And as that happens, that's when you start to see people acting parochial, where you start to see that fostering some territorialism. And once it starts, it just spreads like a cancer.
Now, you just mentioned parochialism. So let's look at what you identify in the book as the three levels of the pyramid of bureaucracy: parochialism, territorialism, and empire building, all of which I'm sure most of us who've worked in organizations have seen on some level at some point. So let's start with parochialism. What do you mean by that?
Parochialism is when you view the entire world through the lens of your one little function. That success to you isn't organizational success or achieving your corporate mission. It's checking off the box that you needed to be checked. And that's all you care about. That's the only thing that matters. So you may force people to, you know, do things that aren't in their best interest, but help your one department. You know, may eliminate exceptions. You may have to have forms filled out in triplicate. You may have to do all sorts of crazy stuff. You know, one case we saw was quality assurance group within a manufacturing plant. You may have a situation where the plant was virtually shut down until a test could be run. And the test would be run and the results would be ready, but the manager wouldn't let the report go out until the memo was in a certain format. And that could delay things by as much as a day.
Interesting.
Because they wanted things done their way. So parochialism, it's my way or the highway, even though it may not be what's best for the company.
Mm-hmm. And then I think most of us have run into somebody who definitely is very territorial about their department or their group. Talk to us a little bit about territorialism and why that's so detrimental.
Sure. Territorialism is when you feel that you have to maintain excessive control over your resources, when you start seeing people hoarding information and not releasing it, when you see open warfare during budget season, you start seeing people finding reasons to spend at the end of the year so they don't, quote-unquote, lose their budget to a department that needs it more, which is probably the right thing to do. But the biggest problem is in over control of people. It's limiting their empowerment, not allowing them to do anything except, you know, support what you feel you need to maintain your own personal dream castle. And it's a fine line, because obviously you need to maintain control and focus. But if the focus is on local success, not broader success, then you start doing things that don't make sense. You start forcing employees to do things that don't always work. For example, have you ever called a customer service call center and it's just been a disaster? It keeps going from bad to worse. And, and you're really frustrated and it's just a disaster. And at the end, the rep says to you, "Vicky, is there anything else I could help you with today?" And you just want to strangle them. but they have to say that. It's what I call a gospel. It's an absolute rule. And in parochial and territorial environments, everything's a gospel. But
yeah.
The truth is, very few things should be.
Right.
So it's looking at that type of control is where the territorialism manifests.
Yeah, and you say in the book, no company would say that it wants to hire brainless robots with no free will, and yet all too often companies script every word. And indeed, of frontline employees, just, you know, as you described, especially that does happen an awful lot in call centers.
Yeah, and not just call centers. You know, several years ago, I went to buy a car, and, you know, I picked up the car on a Sunday. You know, dealerships out here in California are open on Sunday, but, you know, the service department was closed. But the problem was the survey I would get potentially the next day had a question, were you introduced to the manager of the service department? Now, again, these things are done with the best of intentions. Someone at headquarters probably correctly found out that if I have a personal relationship to someone in service, I'm more likely to go back there. But the execution is where these things go wrong. So remember, service is closed. I could get that survey the next day. So I was introduced, no kidding, to a life-size cardboard cutout of the manager of the service department with a cardboard hand propped out.
You're kidding.
Also, I would check that. No, I swear this is true. Also, I would check that yes on the survey, because if I didn't, the rep wouldn't get their bonus.
Oh. That is...
I never went back for service, but it just shows you how crazy some of these things could be. But when you get down to it, there was a very legitimate need behind what led to the crazy behavior, that establishing a personal relationship with someone in service is a good thing. It's the execution where the barriers spring up. Next time you're on an airplane, look at the safety information card, and it'll say on it, if you can't read these instructions and you're seated in an exit...
Okay, I see. I definitely see the irony in that one.
Now need poor execution.
Yeah, definitely. And the level three in the fear pyramid, the pyramid of bureaucracy that you talk about is empire building. And I'm sure, again, we've all come across people who fall into this category. What does that look like?
Well, you know what? Let's say I'm a territorial manager, and I'm tightly controlling information, I'm tightly controlling my people, I'm trying to regain that self-sufficiency to get all those boxes checked off, and I suddenly realize it's not enough. I can't do it. I have dependencies with other departments, and they're being territorial. It's, empire building usually happens in response to the parochial and territorialism of others. I may need, for example, an IT initiative desperately to be done. They have enough money to do three, and they've had 50 requests. So 47 people are going to lose. So what do I do? I may try to form my own IT department. If I may try to form my own HR group within my department, you know, create duplicate functions. You know, one company, they actually had two groups making changes to the same IVR program because two groups couldn't get things done. It just would cause the system to crash. You know, it could also be trying to take over departments either directly or speak for them, make decisions for them. But the costs are just enormous. You see absolute open, bloody warfare during budget season when that happens.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. I've been there myself. And yet, you know, for years and years and years and years, studies have shown that all of these things that, you know, taking away people's freedoms, taking away extra time that you talk about in the book, eliminating opportunities to grow, to gain new skills, restricting information flow, all of those things make us feel powerless, make people feel powerless as employees. And then isn't it just a self-perpetuating thing that creates just more fear then?
Absolutely right, Vicki. Absolutely right. Like I said earlier, it just spreads like a cancer. These are things that seem insurmountable within companies. But you know what? You got to remember, nowhere is it written that on the eighth day, God created barriers and bureaucracy.
Right.
Something that companies did to themselves. I'm sorry. You know, they did it to themselves. And if you did it to yourself, guess what? You can undo it.
Okay.
It's not easy. It takes some work. But if you unpack it and really get to the root cause and respect the often very legitimate need that led to the practice, you can find a better way and undo this. But that's just the first step. once you get rid of the barriers, if you have someone that's, as you said, lived under this fear their whole career and is just crushed, and all of a sudden you say, okay, barriers are gone, go ahead, you're empowered, they're going to say, I'm not so sure. So you have to enable that courageous behavior. You have to create an environment that encourages people to take those first few tentative steps. And at the same time, you have to beware of the courage killers and aggressively root that out of your organization. That cannot be tolerated.
Yeah, one of the things that I see a lot are, and you talk about this as being a courage killer, so that was a good segue, is managers being inconsistent. I see a lot of managers who have the title of manager, but they lack the skills, they have very little authority, and consequently they don't know how to empower their employees, and management can be very inconsistent. And you talk about that as being a courage killer. What are some other courage killers?
The inconsistency is a big one. Courage killer could also be breaking promises. It could be playing the blame game, saying, go ahead and take this risk, but, you know, if it goes bad, you're on your own. It could be all sorts of things like that, but the subjectivity, quite frankly, is a big one. I think part of the problem gets to who do you pick as a manager? Too many companies view management or a management job as a reward, when in reality it's just another job.
Right.
So you should choose the people who have the most management talent to be managers. If you have someone that's great as an individual contributor, find a way for them to grow in that role. You know, maybe senior subject matter experts or trainers or something. But if you have low talent managers, you know, again, desperately trying to hang on, they may be tempted to do this. Finding objective measurements is a great way to root this out, because you can't argue with an objective measure. Every group, at the end of the day, produces something for someone, even internal groups. You know, you should take a subjective measure and slap a number on it and pretend it's objective.
Right.
But instead, take a step back and figure out what's this group adding and measure that.
Right. So let's take a quick look at how we can overcome, like, parochialism, territorialism, empire building. Parochialism, you say the first thing we have to do is get rid of the rules that are hindering organizational success.
Right. As I said, there's different types of rules, and in a parochial environment, everything's a gospel. It's no exceptions. It's always do X no matter what, even if it doesn't make sense. Most rules, I would argue, unless it's a legal requirement or something that's protecting the security of an employee or a customer, should be either a guideline or a ground rule. A guideline is something that's conditional. You know, sure, it's fine to say, is there anything else I could help you with, if you help them in the first place and the customer has time.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe make it a ground rule. Use your judgment, but don't cross this line, and we're going to hold you accountable, you know, based on the results. But the most damaging types of rules that we see in parochial environments aren't really rules. They're what I call ghosts. Ghosts are rules that maybe used to be rules,
right,
or maybe it's something someone just made up. Or whenever you hear, even though this is stupid, it's how we've always done it here, so just keep doing it.
Yeah, I just love that one. I just love that one. How about territory?
Well, you know what? We're with an organization that was riddled with ghosts, and a frontline employee raised his hand and said, why don't we have a ghost-busting party?
That's
and
a great...
And they did, and rooted out all of these horrible practices and saw a big jump in their scores.
Great idea. So, and that's a way that if I'm an employee, I can take an active part in ghost-busting and getting change made. What about for territorialism? How do we overcome territorialism?
Well, it depends how it's manifesting. If it's information, then you have to take some, you know, add some accountabilities about sharing and improve access. Usually it's about an imbalance in empowerment and accountability, where you have, like I said, these prisoners. So you have to look at why is empowerment low. And it's usually not just saying someone has the freedom. The biggest killer of empowerment, quite frankly, is time. If you fill up someone's day so much that they barely can keep their head above water, they can't make an obsession,
mm-hmm.
or an exception. You may also limit training opportunities or do other things. So look at where the problem is. But, you know, to quote Ben Parker from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. So if you give people freedom, hold them accountable.
There we go.
Give them some skin in the game. So that's a good way of getting rid of the territorialism. And then when you move to empire building, you know, that's when the cancer is really spread, and you usually have to do something a little more drastic. It may even require restructuring. But you need two things. You need absolute focus on the mission. Everything is about the mission, and anything that helps the mission is good. Anything that hurts the mission is bad, period. And everything should be aligned and evaluated against that and a set of core operating values. Now, within that, you also should have some guiding principles for your decisions. Would this help overall financial success? Would this help the overall workplace? Would it help our customer relationships? Would it avoid risk or catastrophic failure or liability? If you could answer that question, then it's probably worth doing. If you can't, or it's only for a small local part of the organization, it's probably not worth doing. So again, when you really start to dissect it, it's really not that impossible to undo these things. And when you do, the transformations are pretty remarkable.
Well, great advice. The book is called Breaking the Fear Barrier, How Fear Destroys Companies from the Inside Out and What to Do About It. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Tom?
You know, what I would leave our listeners with is you may be sitting in your office banging your head against a wall and wondering how are you going to succeed in the face of all these problems. And I think it's important to realize that there is hope. Again, these things were created internally. They can be torn down internally. And if you're a manager, you need to watch out. Make sure you're not doing this yourself. But in a barrier-free organization, you unlock that human potential. There's excitement. There's energy. And that's a great place to work and highly successful environments, too, from what we've seen. So no matter how impossible it seems to fight City Hall and tear down these barriers and this bureaucracy, it can be done. So there is hope.
And good news ending there. There is hope, and we can make a difference as just one person in that company. So please do stay with us. That was an interview pre-recorded with Tom Reiger, his book, Breaking Through the Fear Barrier. Please stay with us. We have Jezra Kay coming up, and we're going to talk about managing the unmanageable. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we're going to do a live segment now. Switching gears again. My guest is Jezra Kay. She's a public speaking coach and keynote speaker who helps professionals communicate more effectively for career success and satisfaction. And she's shown CEOs and scientists, law firm partners, university presidents how to become more powerful communicators, more skilled negotiators, and how to become people who ask effectively for what they want and what they need. She's also got an interesting background. She's a former Fortune 500 speechwriter and a former jazz singer and bandleader, along with consultant and executive coach Anne Lair, who was named the generational guru by the Washington Post. Kay has written a new book called Managing the Unmanageable, How to Motivate Even the Most Unruly Employee. Welcome, Jezra Kay. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I wanted just to reiterate, I said this at the top of the hour, but this book, you've written it, the subtitle is How to Motivate Even the Most Unruly Employee. But I think all of the rules and practices and strategies in here apply to unruly friends, unruly family members. I think they apply right across the board. Would you agree?
They do. I agree completely.
So tell us a little bit about what this book's about, why you wrote it, and who it's for.
Well, you know, you just had an interview about breaking the barriers, and it's very much about that kind of scenario at work, where somebody who has the potential to be a good employee has gotten themselves into a way of behaving that's not only not helping their career, it's not helping the business, the team, or you as their manager. So this book was originally conceived as a way to help managers hang on to the good talent that they have, even when that good talent is attached to negative behavior.
And, you know, one of the things I want to start off with, you have a great chapter titled, "Is This Person Really a Wolf in a Suit?" When we're talking about this person who's unmanageable, in our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Is this person really a wolf in a suit or a canary in a coal mine? And I thought that was a great analogy there. So I wonder if you'd share with us what you mean by that.
Of course. In the beginning of the book, we go through a discussion of how the manager, before you do anything else, as the manager, you have to decide whether you're really committed to salvaging this employee. And to make that decision, part of it is facts and figures. You look at their potential, what they've done in the past. You also look at what they've cost you since they became unmanageable. But even more than the numbers, you want to look at what you believe the true value of this person is to your organization. And you're going to have to differentiate between three types of individuals. One is somebody who likes to be unmanageable. They like to be a troublemaker. They are not interested in changing, and they're not going to work with you to improve the situation. We absolutely do not recommend that you invest your time in a person like that. But often, an unmanageable employee is reflecting frustrations or stresses in another part of their life, and with a little bit of guidance and a little bit of clarity, the two of you can work together and get the workplace back to, or perhaps for the first time, functioning in a really effective way.
Mm.
Now, the third scenario is that sometimes your unmanageable employee is what we call the canary in the coal mine. And I don't know if you're, you know, familiar with this piece of lore, but supposedly back in the old days,
I think it is true. Yeah, it is true.
When coal miners went down underground, people were pretty slow to recognize when they're running out of oxygen. I actually know this because I have a little bit of asthma. And you can lose half of your breathing capacity before you become uncomfortable. But a canary isn't like that. They're very sensitive to fluctuations in oxygen, and they will just keel over. They'll just go. And if you have a canary in the coal mine with you, when they keel over, it's time to get out, even if you can't tell that anything is wrong.
Right.
So obviously, it's not time to get out of the workplace when your canary keels over. But if you look at your unmanageable, sometimes you'll find that they are reacting or even overreacting to a situation that's bothering a lot of other people in the company. They're just the ones who are showing the symptoms first.
Right. And there are people who are not afraid to voice their opinions, and they may seem, you know, loud and disruptive. But as you said, they're often the mouthpiece for the rest of the group.
That's right. And sometimes when you listen, you may find out that they have valuable things to say. You can't rule that out.
Right.
You really have to understand, is it the person? Is it the situation? Am I contributing, just like your previous guest suggested? These are all things to think about. And quite a bit of our book is focused on getting clear about what you think is going on with this person.
Right. And you know what I always found key as a manager and in other situations now, some of the most ugly challenges I had as a manager were when things were taken out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about that a lot. If you determine somebody, yes, they are disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is coming directly from them, say, what's the context that this situation is happening within? How do we make sure we're getting the right context on things? Because that is key, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you completely. We have a program. It's called the 5 C's, and it's a series of steps that you go through one by one because each one builds on the one that happened before it. So we just talked about the first one, which is really commit or quit, and that's where where you as a manager have to do a little bit of quiet thinking or noisy thinking if you'd rather go out and have a few beers with a friend. However you like to think, you know, think about whether you're really committed to this person, because if you're not, there's no point in going down this road. Then the second C is communicate, and that's where you get to check your ideas about the context. And I agree with you. You want to have a theory about what you believe is going on, but then you've got to go back to the unmanageable employee, and you've got to say, hey, what's up? You know, have you noticed that you're doing something different? Because I have noticed that you are complaining 5 or 6 times every time we meet as a team, and you didn't used to be like that. What's up? What's going on? And then you get to find out if your theory about what's going on is correct. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not tell you at first. Sometimes you've got to work for that trusting relationship where people will actually open up and mention that they might have a problem at home or a health issue, or maybe, you know, something's going on at work that they may be slow to want to share with you. But mm-hmm. if you can get them to share, and most people, if they think that you really are interested in their welfare, it's so important to be non-blaming in this. I mean, right. You may want to rip their head off, but you can't approach them that way.
Right, right.
You really have to kind of come to terms with being the good guy here, or else why would they trust you, you know?
I actually remembered one situation that I ran into many years ago when I got hauled into HR as a senior manager and questioned about why I'd been riding somebody's back, as she put it. And she had been reading magazines at work while customers were waiting. And so I think that to me kind of put the whole, you know, make sure you get the context right on this situation.
That's right. That was a really failed communication. And in fact, all they had to do was say, Vicki, we hear there's been some stress between you and so-and-so. What do you think is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And you would have straightened them out right away.
Right. And this person, it turned out, actually wanted to get fired. She wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. And so there are times when we just can't do anything, when we can't put things right. But I like the 5 C's that you mentioned. You talked about, you know, committing or quitting, communicating, clarifying goals and roles. That's so critical, because if we're on different pages there, we're going to end up with different results.
Right.
Coaching is a huge one, and creating accountability. That's, as I go into companies and consult with people, that's where I see them failing the most, on creating accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you recommend people start with creating accountability?
Well, we're pretty big on metrics, and it's interesting because, you know, there are people for whom metrics and facts and figures come easily. There are people for whom that's more difficult. We've got something for everybody in here, because obviously communicating and coaching are all about the relationship and the trust, but creating accountability is about sitting down with your unmanageable employee and coming up with ways to measure whatever the problem is, whether that's a certain level of output or how much business they're going to bring in, or if you're asking for a behavioral change, then that would be the metric. So, for instance, if somebody on my team has been very, very rude to his teammates and I'm asking him not to do that, we're going to have zero tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Then I need to keep track of exactly when and where and what I observed if I see that he's falling off of that agreed upon, path.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to be able to say, look, in the last 2 weeks, and let me show you the documentation, there have been 6 episodes where you were rude in a way that disrupted your ability to work closely with somebody else. And we've discussed that that's not acceptable. So we're going to meet in another week, and I want to see 0.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1. You know, you're human. You can slip once, but no. And, you know, got to be an apology if this happens again. You have got to get straight with the person that you offended.
Right. And you talk about that in the book, as a manager, or, you know, maybe as a parent coaching your teenagers, you've got to have relentless persistence.
You do. And isn't that what makes it difficult? Because you're doing your own job.
Yep.
And supervising other people as well. Life is not all about this one acting out person. And by the way, you know, the teenager analogy is such a great one, because first of all, they're just wonderful at finding our buttons and pushing them. And
so is
an unmanageable employee.
Absolutely.
And also an unmanageable employee may be acting like a teenager, and darned if they don't get you to act like one too.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think this book is it's a great tool. There are so many useful coaching questions in here, coaching tools in here, follow-up tools. I mean, it's just jam-packed full of information and very easy to read. Written with your co-author, Anne Lair. Jezra Kay, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Time just whizzed by. The book is called Managing the Unmanageable, How to Motivate Even the Most Unruly Employee. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And again, my guest there, Jezra Kay, her book, Managing the Unmanageable. And you can just Google them. That book's going to pop right up. It really is full of great tools. Please do stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live, did you accomplish everything you wanted to this year? If not, Harvard Business Review blogger Peter Bregman says just give him 18 minutes before another year slips away. Tune in next Monday at noon Pacific time to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And in this segment, we're going to be talking with Katie Davis. I actually sat down with Katie Davis last week, and she shared her journey with me then. But when she was just 18 years old, she went on a very short trip with her church. It literally changed her life forever. And more importantly, it changed the lives of hundreds of orphans who'd not only lost their entire families, they'd lost all hope. So you think one person can't make a difference, think again. Let me tell you a little bit about Amazimar, which is the foundation she founded when she was just 19 years old. And Amazimar, I want to tell you, means truth. And let's just go ahead and bring you that interview, and Katie can share the journey in her own words. Katie Davis. Well, Katie Davis, I want to welcome you to the show today. Very pleased to have you here. And we're here today to talk about the work you're doing in Uganda and your book, Kisses from Katie. All of this began for you. You lived in Nashville, Tennessee. You were a class president, as I understand it. You went on a very short trip, a mission trip to Uganda at Christmas time when you were 18 years old. And that instantly changed your life, right?
Yes, it did. I was so drawn to the people of Uganda. They are so joyful and so gracious, and I was also so overwhelmed by the immense needs that I saw and thought, I've got to do something. I don't know what I can do, but I've got to do something to try to help.
Now, so you went back home then, and what happened? What kind of thoughts and what kind of ideas were going through your mind at that point?
Before I returned home, I had been approached by a pastor who runs an orphanage there in Uganda, and he had asked me if I would be willing to come back longer term and help him do some stuff. He was starting a kindergarten program for the children in his orphanage, and he wanted some help teaching there and setting it up. And so I came back with that idea in mind, and after thinking and praying about it for several months, decided that I did want to go back to Uganda. It was going to be like an interim year between high school and college. I was just going to be there for a year. So went ahead and made that commitment, and then, of course, once I got on the ground in Uganda, I found it impossible to leave.
Yeah, and I gather this was not a popular decision with your parents who wanted you to go to college, and your little brother was very sad. Your friends all thought you were crazy.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of pushback, especially from my parents. They just want me to be happy and successful, and so they thought that a college education was definitely the best way to achieve that. So they were not excited when I did not want to come back and go to school, and I did have friends who would make just kind of side comments or remarks that let me know how they really felt, that they thought this was a little bit insane. But God has really changed a lot of people's hearts, and people have come a long way, and I feel like my parents are so very supportive now, and even my friends, a lot of them have gotten back on board and are very supportive.
Well, good. Well, probably because you put your money where your mouth was. You actually went out and you walked the talk, didn't you? you're just 19 years old in 2008, and you decided to start a child sponsorship program. Tell us a little bit about that, and tell us what it's like for those kids and why this came to you that you should start this child sponsorship program.
I was working at an orphanage, and I was teaching there, and I was noticing two things that were happening. One is that children who were in my kindergarten class would stop coming to school, and after a bit of investigation on why, I found out that it was because a lot of their parents, or even for those of them who were orphaned and living with grandparents or aunts or uncles, there was no one who was able to continue to pay for their schooling. And on the flip side of that, were parents who were living and were bringing their children to try to drop them off at the orphanage. Even though the children weren't technically orphans, they knew that if the children lived at the orphanage, they would get to go to school and have food and have medicine. And I thought, well, something's wrong with this picture. Can't there be a way that these children are provided with their basic needs while still staying at home and living with their family and being raised in their community? And so that's how our ministry, Amazima, was born, just watching these children as they struggle to, you know, they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, some of them, and they would walk miles to fetch water in a little jerry can to bring back, and some of them go and dig in the field before school to try to find food. And that's the lucky ones who are even able to attend school. And so I thought, at least in this community, I want to do something to change that. And I began matching sponsors in the United States who would donate a certain amount of money, and then I would match them with a child in Uganda and use that money to pay for their school and their health care and their food.
Mm. Now, you started out with, you just planned to have 40 children in the program I saw on your website, and you now have over 400 children in the program. It really doesn't cost that much for us as Americans, $300 a year. But, I mean, to put that in perspective, how much would, if a Ugandan was working, how much would they make in a year, roughly?
A Ugandan might, at a well-paying job, might make $40 a month, and at an okay, not so well-paying job, but what the average probably makes, $15 a month.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it costs $25 a month, in the way that Amazima has calculated, it costs $25 a month to send your child to school and feed them. And so if you have Sometimes it's too expensive to even provide for one child, but if you have multiple children, it's surely very difficult to provide for them.
Mm. So your goal really is getting them to school so they have the education, so they better their lives long term. And I noticed on your website, you don't really take volunteers over there from Western states. Are you trying to... You know, there's that saying, feed a man and you feed him for a day, teach him to fish and, you know, he's fed for a lifetime. Is that where you're coming from with this?
Right, exactly. I think that short-term mission trips and opportunities to volunteer overseas are fantastic, and that's how I got started. And I'm so thankful for organizations that do accept those kind of volunteers. But Amazima has decided to really make an effort to invest in the local Ugandan people. And so if we can't find someone Ugandan to do the job we want done, then we need to train someone Ugandan to do the job we want done, because we really want to employ locals, and we have a really awesome, awesome local staff on the ground.
Mm. Now, you're about 22 right now, as I understand. Where did you get this drive from? Because at 22, most people are, you know, thinking about their next party or, you know, geez, I want to save up for that car or can't wait to go away on holiday. Where does that inner drive with you come from, Katie?
It comes completely from Jesus. It's absolutely nothing that is in my human flesh, but I think that just to think about Jesus and his sacrifice for us, nothing else I can do in my life looks big or looks like a sacrifice.
And so you want to, I know, grow this program. There are many ways that people can help if they're interested, and maybe we'll talk about those in a minute. But what right now are your primary concerns on a day-to-day basis when you're working there? What are your primary concerns?
I think my everyday goal is just to be able to love the people in front of me in the way Christ would have me love them, because I think that's how this whole thing has come into be. It was never a plan of moving to a different country or having a big organization with all these children being supported through it. My goal was just to love the people that he was putting in front of me. And as I've done that, it's just grown and grown and grown. And so I just continue with the goal of saying yes to the opportunities and the needs that he places in front of me. And he's faithful to multiply that.
Now, you are actually, I'm not sure if you're, your website said you've now adopted the 13 children that you were talking about earlier in the book. But is that true, that you've actually adopted 13 children now?
Well, we're in as far as adoption paperwork process, we're still in process with some of them. Some of them have legal guardianship. Some of them have just foster care. Some of them have adoption. So it's a three-year process. Mm-hmm. In Uganda that you have to go through. And so in order to be in compliance with all the Ugandan laws and respectful of that, I have several different kids in several different parts of the paperwork process. But, you know, if you use the word adoption to just mean accepting someone into your family, then absolutely they're already accepted into my family. God has already knit our hearts together as a family, and mm-hmm. they are my children. And so, yes, I have 13 little girls.
That's amazing. I think mothers with 2 and 3 are probably like, what? But I want to just read this. I want to share this with our listeners. This was on your blog, and you are reading, you're looking at your daughter's birth certificate, who was born in a camp. And you write, I can't really wrap my mind around the fact that my beloved daughter spent the first years of her life in a place that is so beyond my comprehension. Camp, this word that I want for no one in this world and hate for my daughter, this is all we have of the first years of her life. I want her to be a baby so I can strap her on me and hold her there, and she will feel secure and safe and protected. I want to be the person who taught her to write her name and how much fun it is to make mud pies. And I want to be the person who laughed with her when she lost her first tooth. I want to know where the scars came from that she can't remember the stories about. I entered motherhood through a different door, and I get different kind of stretch marks. So tell us a little bit about your stretch marks.
Sure. I mean, of course, with adoption, it comes with this different kind of motherhood. And while it's still motherhood, and I believe that I love my children as much as I would if they were created in my womb, there are parts that you miss as an adoptive mother. And there are those places that you grieve for your children, because while adoption is a beautiful way to make a family, it's also a tragic way to make a family. There's some tragedy there. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I experience all the things that a normal mother experiences as far as sibling rivalry and can't you stop pinching your sisters or, you know, whatever the normal looks like. But then we also experience a lot of pain and trauma from their pasts as far as, you know, a child who knows what it is to be starving. So for the first 6 months she lives in your home, she hides food under her pillow because she's not really 100% convinced that there is going to be another meal sometime soon.
Now, I was looking at the website and saw some video on there, too, of the women who are making jewelry to help support programs. Many of the women before, you know, had been abandoned by husbands. They had kids to raise. There's nothing around. They're living in huts. And many of them turned to prostitution and are now making jewelry. So tell us a little bit about that program that's helping them and also helping other programs.
Sure. Well, Amazima, you know, we decided we wanted to branch out and really, really kind of get at the root of this problem. We have these children. They're not getting their basic needs met. We're trying to find them sponsors. The reason they're not getting their basic needs met is because their parents and guardians also didn't go to school, also didn't have these basic needs met, and so therefore are unable to get any kind of a job. And so in the slum community of Misesi, where I do a lot of work, so many women are just so unable to provide for their children, and that just breaks my heart as a mother because I find such joy in being able to provide for my children. And so they're turning to these dangerous things, prostitution, alcohol brewing, picking through just old scrap metal, things that are so detrimental to you. And we wanted to create a way out for them. So we have a beading group now where these women are trained to make jewelry, and they're able to make this jewelry and sell it. Amazima buys it from them and then resells it here in the United States. And a portion of that money goes directly to the women of the community, or the women who made the necklaces. A portion of that money goes straight into a bank account that they are saving their money, and we're helping them create a plan for what they would like to do with that money in the future. A lot of them would like to buy their own plot of land and build a small house on it so that they don't have to pay rent to these landlords anymore. Mm. A lot of them want to start their own small business as a way to kind of move forward even more in supporting their own families. And then anything above and beyond what is paid to the women that Amazima makes on the necklaces goes directly to our feeding program, which actually feeds all the children 5 times a week of that same village that the ladies come from. And so they know that by making these necklaces, not only are they helping themselves and their families, they're helping the entire community be provided with nutritious meals.
And that was an interview with Katie Davis. Her book, Kisses from Katie, written with Beth Clark, writer Beth Clark. But the book is called Kisses from Katie, A Story of Relentless Love and Redemption. And I think you have to agree, she is just an amazing young woman, just 22 years old. And look at what she's already accomplished. And, you know, heaven knows what she's going to accomplish over the next few years, because she is one very determined young woman. You can find out more about her at amazima.org, amazima.org, or kissesfromkatie.blogspot.com. And I also wanted to give you the website for my first guest today, who was Tom Reiger from Gallup. And you can find out more about him at gallup.com. Just type in his name, Tom Reiger. Before we go today, I have a couple of minutes here, and I wanted to tell you about the Tacoma Holiday Gift Shows. It's holidaygiftshows.com. It's a Food and Gift Festival is supposed to be one of the largest around, and it looked pretty huge when I looked at the website. I don't have any affiliation with them, but I have a really good friend who's going. She's going to be one of the artists in action down there. There's going to be an artist village. So, Eric, you live down in Tacoma. Are you going to go?
I'll try and make it, yeah. This is at the Tacoma Dome?
It's at the Tacoma Dome. The
main, you know it's going to be big then.
The main area and the expo hall. And there's what they call an artist village. They've got over 35 hand-on artist demonstrations. And if you go down, go see my friend Kathleen Callan at Chanteuse Designs. She is. She designs great green bags and aprons, and she writes a cooking blog, and she's an actress and does voiceover work. She's very interesting. Her work is...
We should get her on the show sometime.
Her work is really superior quality.
Excellent.
It is absolutely super. She designs purses. That's one of the big things right now she's designing. So
never too early to start your Christmas shopping, that's for sure.
That's for sure. And the Tacoma show runs from the Food and Gift Festival runs from Wednesday through Sunday this week. All right, well, that takes us to the end of our show. So I want to thank you for being with us. You can find me at conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617. Until next week, live well, live strong.